I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. Welcome back to the show. This show is where we host thoughtful conversations about the issues shaping our communities, our economy, and our future. If you value these conversations, then I invite you to support this work. Your donations help us to continue bringing together leaders and thinkers who are willing to have honest discussions about our state and country. Visit lockedin.cash to become a reoccurring supporter. Your contribution helps us continue producing independent conversations that elevate our region. Today's guest is North Carolina Senator Dana Caudill Jones. Before joining the state Senate, she spent years serving on the Winston-Salem Forsyth County School Board, including during one of the most difficult periods in modern education history, the global pandemic. Now she's helping shape statewide policy on issues ranging from foster care reform and social media legislation to property taxes, school accountability, and the state budget. Senator Caudill Jones, thank you for locking in. I think this is your inaugural appearance on the Locked In show, so thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, so you've been quite busy. You took over a seat for a mutual friend of ours, Joyce Krawczyk, who I love to death. All of the great work that I was able to do during the McCrory administration on the Energy Policy Council was a result of my relationship with Joyce. And I just think the world of her. Have you spoken to Senator Krawczyk here recently or?
Yes, I have. I do keep up with her. She is a very busy lady, and we are so excited that she has joined the Forsyth County Board of Elections.
I noticed that. I thought maybe she was fully done, but I should have known better that Joyce can't fully retire from anything, especially when it comes to our community and trying to be a catalyst for change. So I just have a tremendous amount of respect, not only for her, but her husband, Ray, too, who I've actually done some real estate work with in the past. Just an amazing family and have done great things for the Triad area. You know, I mentioned at the in the intro that you made a transition from the school board to the state Senate. So let's just start there so that my audience sort of gets a full introduction of who you are, Senator. How did the experience on the school board sort of shape the way that you're now approaching policymaking at the state level?
Well, you know, one of the things that really taught me working on the Board of Education for those 8 years. The first 4 years, we were a partisan board. So the first 4 years we were Republican controlled, and I was the chair of the board at that time. And then in 2018, Democrats took the majority. And so I found myself in the minority. But I think one of those things that that it taught me was to be which I always have done, but it proved true to have relationships with everyone that you're working with. Really, you know, really and truly, the one thing that we can control is how we treat other people. And so, you know, I hope that when people encounter me, whether it's on a board or just out, they realize that you know, I see them, I hear them, and I value their opinions. And I value them, even if we don't always agree. And I think that's how I have continued to work in the space in Raleigh. That is one of the things that that those on all sides of the aisle will tell you about my predecessor, Joyce. And I think that that's why she was such a successful leader in the state. And so that's been important to me. And before I was on the Board of Education, I also served 10 years on the town council in Kernersville. And so having local government experience, as well as experience in the education space, I believe all of that lifelong experience has helped me prepare to be a good legislator in Raleigh.
You know, I totally forgot that you spent quite a bit of time on town council in Kernersville, because now that you say that, I recall you and I being together at a meeting, I feel like Jake and Brooke Cashin had put together at some point in Kernersville, way back when, and but totally forgot that. So no, you've been at it for quite a while. And you know, to my audience, I will fully back up Senator Jones on this. I stopped her at a coffee shop one morning. She was definitely in a rush to get out of there, but I wanted to share some issues with her that I was experiencing and some thoughts I had about our city councilor in Winston-Salem. And she certainly sat down with me for a moment and obliged. So we always just thankful for that level of service from any public servant. You know, you talked about relationships while you're on the school board. One person that you got, I'd say, somewhat close to that the public probably didn't fully expect was Commissioner Malachi Woodbury at the time. She's no longer on the school board. Now she's a Forsyth County commissioner. Talk a little bit about that experience and the relationship that you and her developed across the aisle, especially during COVID.
Absolutely. So to go back in time just a little bit, I was coming off of being the chair of the school board. We knew that Shay would be elected as the new chairman. And so there may be some agitators out there in the community that wanted to try to pit Shay and I against each other. And so both being professionals, we decided that we would start to have coffee and start to meet and get to know one another. And we were not going to let outsiders kind of figure out what we were going to do and how we were going to lead. And so Shay and I both enjoy exercising, walking, all those kinds of things. And so we found some common ground and space that we enjoyed each other's company. She is a good friend, even though we basically cancel out each other's votes most of the time. But you know, she's a good person. I respect her a great deal. Excited for her as she's serving as a commissioner. But again, you can, you know, ask about each other's family, get to know one another. I think that helps you even in those spaces when you disagree. You can always listen to someone's opinion, and we grow from that. And sometimes I would say probably through strong conversation that we would have, maybe offline, not in public. Sometimes we might have reached compromises and could see each other's viewpoints. I also had a great relationship with Elizabeth Motzinger, and we kind of did the same thing.
You know, I love Ms. Motzinger. Our ideologies don't always align, but I really respect her level of passion and just her commitment to service. And again, we don't have to share the same ideas to respect one another and be able to admire your ability to just be a good public servant. I really wish that you and Malachi Woodbury would take a trip to Washington and maybe hold a workshop so that Speaker Johnson and Leader Jeffries might also take a page out of your book so that we can get more done, you know, here within our country right now. Because I tell you, there's a lot of concern right now, I think, from the public when it comes to our public institutions and their inability right now to really work together to move the needle on some really big ideas. You know, there's also a bipartisan concern about social media's impact on young people. Their mental health, addiction, anxiety, attention spans, even self-worth. I'm totally convinced, Senator, that our brains are not hardwired to be on social media 24/7 and receiving the massive amount of information that we're constantly having to digest. So I know you and Representative Zinger recently passed legislation restricting or banning teen access altogether. Talk a little bit more about that bill and sort of what parents and families in North Carolina can expect going forward.
Absolutely. So Representative Zinger passed over in the House back, I think it was back in March in the long session, a House Bill 301. And that has some restrictions around teens on social media. And we're still kind of working out some of the details around that piece of it, but it was over in rules in the Senate. I had filed a Senate bill around safe and responsible use of AI in K-12 education. And so we took some of that language from that bill and made it an amendment to Representative Zinger's bill. We feel like it's good legislation, and it's really around social media and AI consumption for our young people. And so right now it's over in committee in the Senate, and we're working out some of the details on that. So hopefully we will have that heard before a committee. It went through education on the Senate side, and I think it's in J committee right now, working on some of that language. But hopefully we can get that across the finish line for North Carolinians. And again, it's just around protecting our students. You know, every time they're in front of these chatbots that are a lot of times built into AI education tools, which are great tools, but we want to make sure the vendors are doing the right thing. They're not collecting data around our students. Part of the bill also will give instruction and support and tools to our teachers so that they can use AI effectively to help them with their load. It certainly can't take the place of a great teacher. We know they're the number one thing that affects our students in the classroom, but ways that they can use these tools in safe and ethical and responsible ways. And then also the bill changes our computer science curriculum, and it adds an AI component to it, because what we're hearing from the workforce is that our students right out of high school need to have some sort of AI competency, since this is something that's being used in all industries.
No, I would totally agree. I'm certainly on record saying that, you know, our education systems, K through 12 and college level, need to embrace the AI revolution. I know right now you've got some education institutions that are resisting it. They don't necessarily want students using the AI. But I think that's akin to resisting the internet in the 90s. It's just going to happen. And I think it won't necessarily dumb down what our students do, but I think it will shift and change how they go about learning. And they certainly need to understand how to use the tool to expand their knowledge. So I'm happy to hear that North Carolina is at the forefront of that. How does some of the enforcement on some of this actually work? I mean, when you talk about restricting access for teens, talk a little bit about how that actually looks like day to day in real life.
So I think, you know, trying to figure out what the magic number is going to be that says, you know, this is the age that teens should have access to a social media account. And then also, what ages should there be a teen account, which the parent really has to, they have the parental controls around. And so it's much like there are applications, apps that parents have now around screen time on iPads and phones and that sort of thing. And so giving them some of those controls when it comes to social media platforms. And all those things are, you know, that's the hard part, trying to figure out some of those details around the bill. It's modeled much after a bill from Florida. And so we're just working on that language and trying to tweak that.
You know, you're spending more of your time in Raleigh, but I know you keep a close eye on what's happening back here in Forsyth County. There's been, you know, somewhat of a big jump in violence within our school systems. And oftentimes this violence is originating from social media and then spilling over into real life and spilling over in some really dangerous kind of ways. Does the bill address any of the violence that we're seeing happening within the school system and the way that students are using social media to encourage people to show up to these incidents?
Right. So the bill really doesn't speak to that. It really is around the some of those restrictions. But one of the things that we have to do, I think we're all responsible for this as adults, whether we have young kids or school-aged children, but we all need to be paying attention to what's going on with our youth. And when I see these videos posted, when you turn on the local news or you open up your social media feed and it's on, you know, some of our local channels, it's very troubling that the teens are out at some of the times of night and places that they are, which they should not be. And also that instead of sometimes, you know, we see this instead of helping or stopping something, they want to kind of amplify it and record it. And that's really troubling. So, you know, when people say, I don't have kids in school anymore. Well, you know, this is our future. And so we all have to, we should all be concerned about what's happening to the mental health of our youth. and seeing this violence. We also have to, you know, talk about the family's responsibility. And when I say family, everyone's family looks different and your makeup looks different, but family is really responsible for these young people and their actions. And so I think it's, you know, it's time that we talk about those, you know, family values and just being kind humans to one another. And the escalation of all of these weapons and wanting to, you know, cause all this harm. You know, we really have seen this. I go back to, and I think you talked about it, when our schools were closed down for COVID, when we were locked down, there were some not great people in neighborhoods that consumed a lot of time of these young people. And so we saw an increase in gang affiliation and an increase in violence. And we really haven't recovered from that.
Yeah. And my concern is that it's becoming normalized. You know, when you talk about the fact when a violent incident happens, someone is more willing to record it than to actually, you know, intercede and do something about it. That tells me that the behavior is really becoming normalized. And I think our youth spend a lot of time on YouTube and watching television, and violence in itself has just become just a part of the normal fabric. And I think that's a huge concern if we can't help our teens to understand the difference between this digital reality that they're being faced with and then actual reality, like real life, that they're having to live day to day. So I appreciate what you and so many others are trying to do within that space. You know, State Auditor Dave Bolick recently raised concerns about a massive increase in Medicaid autism therapy billing and possible weaknesses in oversight systems. Some reports suggest billing for autism-related services exploded over recent years, prompting investigations and calls for reform. You know, how should lawmakers balance protecting our vulnerable children who genuinely need these services while also protecting taxpayers from fraud and abuse?
That's, you know, I so appreciate Dave and the work that his office is doing. And yes, when those numbers came back, and just to break it down, ABA services for autistic children, just the one line item increased over 200%. I think it was over like 248%. And so what we're finding is we have some bad actors in providers, some out of state who are, you know, requiring more hours than are needed, overbilling, not delivering. And at the end of the day, when fraud occurs, it really hurts those children that need the services. They're not receiving what they need. It hurts the children, it hurts the families. And so we've got to ensure some measures with DHHS, and I know our health committees and health chairs. I do not serve in that space, but I know that they're working hard with DHHS to put some of those things in place. And our agency doesn't want that to happen as well. But it's a huge agency. Medicaid is so large and it encumbers so many different pockets. We have to put some gaps and some measures in there. And we have done some of that. We passed a couple of weeks ago, some measures that would reduce these requirements that some of these bad actors were requiring for services, and put some measures in place and said that they had to be licensed in the state of North Carolina, couldn't have the licensing outside the state. So many things were involved in that. But our you know, our Medicaid for those who need this safety net and this stopgap to help them, we can't help people adequately when we have fraud involved.
Are there any criminal pathways being pursued as it relates to some of the fraud and abuse that we're talking about?
Well, and I think that's part of the investigation, and that's probably what the auditor's office is going to work on, as really digging down into this. And that's his role and his agency's role. So really dig down in, figure out what's going on, and see if there's really some criminal charges. And I'm sure that we will bring those if we find that.
You know, State Auditor Bolick has been pretty active and busy since coming into this term. He's also the same one that was looking at the Winston-Salem Forsyth County school system last year. And I think, the $75 million that everybody was trying to explain and understand. Where did everything actually end up landing with that? I know that the school system eventually was able to get some money from the state, got some money from the county. They also made some changes internally to be able to close the gap. But it just felt like we never heard much else. I mean, beyond that, once they actually got the money they needed.
Well, you know, from what the auditor's report really showed is there was no embezzlement of money or anything like that. And I think that was when you hear when things are overspent that large, that's what you think of. But, you know, really and truly, a lot of money is not really transferred directly to the district. You know, from state funding, a lot of it is paying positions, teachers, principals on state money, but it's not money that's kind of just sitting in someone's account and they wrote themselves a check. The bad thing is that it was bad management. And, you know, I think when you look at the blame, you have to look at the leadership there. And that was the then superintendent and the CFO at that time. And so I believe that they had a lot of extra dollars for COVID. They hired a tremendous amount of positions. They never really cut those things back. And so they just simply overspent and it caught up with them.
Yeah, I know Representative Zinger came on my show last year. He was pretty fired up about it. And at the time, of course, it's like the fog of war. At the time, he even thought that there might be some fraud or some abuse, you know, at bay there. So, you know, right now, the school system finds themselves back in the headlines. They're facing another financial budget shortfall. So from your perspective as a former board member, How did the district arrive back to this moment again? I think they're back in the news. There's somewhere around a $30 or $40 million shortfall that they're facing now.
Well, I think what the district finds themselves in is enrollment decline, and they have to figure out a way to win back families into their system. And the reasons families left was because they felt like the system was failing them. And so they are going to have to kind of step up their game and lure, you know, it's we have competition now. And so and parents have choices. And that's why I strongly believe in parental choice. And so you can't just be mediocre. You can't just kind of halfway prepare yourself. You have to win these families back into your district. And so what they're seeing is continued funding that they no longer receive. And so it's not a funding cut, as many people will say, but you're paid so much per pupil. And so you're not receiving those funds when your enrollment continues to decline. And so that's, you know, we saw a strong leave from Winston-Salem Forsyth County Schools during COVID. And part of that was because we were one of the last districts to go back completely in person when we had charter schools and private schools and other public school districts around us who were back in person. And so, you know, just parents were fed up with that. They knew that this was really harming their children academically and socially, emotionally. And so they have found other options and they have never returned. So I think that they really need to seek after those families and show them the good things that happen. And there are great things that happen in Winston-Salem Forsyth County Schools. I think they just have to get that messaging out there so that they can get some of that money and those students back. The other thing is during my time there, from when I started to the end, the central office grew tremendously. And, you know, my concern, I think, as a taxpayer is what I'm hearing, and I'm not on that board, but what I hear is a lot of cuts to the school building, especially in EC areas. And that saddens me. And I feel like, again, our actual school buildings take most of the cuts. And I'm not so sure that central office shouldn't be the one that gets cut first.
No, I totally understand. And I was following a story in Florida where public schools are having to compete, like they're literally having to bring on marketing agencies so that they can compete against some of these other options that have been created. Now, I think to play devil's advocate with you, I think if we had some teachers or school administrators a part of this conversation today, they might argue that the reason that all these options have exploded onto the scene is because of the state legislature and some of the things you guys have done to create all these options. And they might even argue that they predicted some of this would happen as you guys created so many options. So, you know, to play devil's advocate with you, what would be your response to that assertion?
Well, I think it's just like anything. Competition is great because you need to bring your A game every day, and you're not the only option. And parents clearly want choice for their students, and they want to feel that they are welcomed into the school building. Schools have a parent's most precious possession, and that's their child. And so they want to feel like it's safe. They want to feel as though they're a partner with the school as they're educating their child. And they want to make sure that teachers and administrators are not overstepping the lines when it comes to you're the educator, but you're not the parent. And, you know, I heard those things when I served on the school board. I think we hear those things from parents, from at church or wherever you are. If you have friends who have kids in school right now, K-12 education, those are things that are on their minds. And so, you know, I would say that what the legislature has done is listen to the voice of parents and listen to their concerns and open up pathways to give choice for everyone. And no matter what zip code you live in, no matter what your annual income looks like, because of the state legislature and opportunity scholarships, everyone can make a choice in their child's education. And parents, some in the education space may not like that, but parents like it. And we're going to continue to do that. And I think overall as well, it's not either or. You can support opportunity scholarships and still support public education. And the majority of our students are still in public schools. And I'm a product of Winston-Salem Forsyth County School. My son attended public school. And so I support public education. Just because you support parental choices does not mean that you do not support public schools.
You know, I'm also a product of public education. I attended Louisville and went to Haynes and graduated from West Forsyth, and still have so many friends and relationships from that period in my life. I'm so grateful to see so many of my classmates who've went off and did some really great things, and just thankful to have been a part of that experience. But when I think back to my time in public schools, you know, I remember schools like Carver, for example, used to be very, very strong. You know, we used to love going over on a Friday night to a Carver High School football game, and it would just be packed. And it was just so exciting and a lot of energy. When I look at schools like Carver, public schools like Carver now, I don't see that same kind of energy. I do see a huge shift. And it does feel like with the increased number of options that parents now have, which I actually am in favor of, Senator. So I agree with the ideology around parental choice. But when you look at schools that are in some of these low-income communities and areas like Carver and several others, what is your message to them? I mean, as this competition increases, is it just okay if they fail and maybe fall out of the system? Should we be doing more things to subsidize and prop up some of these schools that are in low-income areas? What are your thoughts about how we address that element?
Oh, absolutely. I think part of that is it is our responsibility, and our schools do. Our lower income schools do receive more funding. And so we have Title I funds that have always been there. You know, one of the things is that I think it relies a lot on our community. Our school's a reflection of the community that the school is placed in. And so when we think about, do we have pride in our community? Do we want to get involved? And so, you know, I go back to the adults and say, what can we do to support these particular schools? And that's really where we are. So you're right. Carver was a powerhouse when I was attended and graduated from East Forsyth High School. Lots of competition between lots of rivals back then. You know, one of the things as well is that have we spread ourselves too thin in some of our schools? I think there's a strong conversation that probably needs to be made around some consolidation around some of our high schools, because we have a lot of buildings that are sitting, I would say, around, you know, only half occupied. And so what does that look like? And if you combined those and you could combine those resources, would that be one way to strengthen the schools? And not just Carver. I think there are several areas that we can look at that. And so if you were to do that, could the funding sources increase for the school, and then also just bring the population back to the building? But some of that also is around programming, I think, as well. And you can position programming in certain areas to attract students to the space.
Well, we often have to look at consolidation within the private sector, and so I'm a huge advocate of within the public sector, not just in schools, but across government. Sometimes you need to look at consolidation to improve efficiency. So I totally agree. One thing that people and teachers can look forward to is that we seem like we've got a budget that's about to pass or has already passed, and there's going to be a huge increase for teacher pay. And from what I read in the news, looks like our teachers will become number one in the South in terms of compensation. I know there was a huge rally at Raleigh by teachers across the state. Did that have any impact on some of the thinking in Raleigh with all the teachers coming down for the protests?
No, it didn't. I don't think that was their shining moment that day to close down schools and you know, impact families in such a negative way where they were scrambling. We were talking about, you know, when families have to be at work and now they're trying to figure out how to have childcare. Do I miss work? I didn't really agree with that decision. They're close, very close to being on break, and they could have come down to Raleigh and exercised their constitutional right and have a rally and really be able to talk to legislators. You know, they came down on a Friday when they know most of us, that's our travel day back home. It's a little, that was a little disappointing that they did that, but they deserve, our teachers do deserve a raise. We did need to elevate them to the highest paid in our region. We'll continue to work on pay. But, you know, I will just say our local teacher association, they do not reach out to me to ask for things or to even just sit down and have a conversation. And that's a little disheartening when you would think that they would. You would think that they would want to sit down and have a good conversation with their delegation so that we can work on things. But I will say that I do not believe that their particular voice, FCAE or NCAE, really are the voices of all of our super educators. And so we do know that the number one effective thing for a student is a competent, well-trained professional teacher in the classroom. And so that's what we want to attract. That's what we want for all of our students. And so that's the goal. So certainly increasing their compensation, but also wanting to make sure that that we find ways to elevate teaching again as a profession. And like we have other professionals. And so I applaud. I have friends who are teachers and they're wonderful. They do such great things. Matter of fact, if you're out with one of them and you run across someone that was one of their former students, they can't wait to go over and see them and talk to them. And so, you know, that they do make such an important difference in the lives of students. And I remember, I mean, when I was in school, I can still have those fond memories of those teachers who really made a difference in my life. I also think that if you ask me that particular teacher, and you wanted me to know if they were Republican, who they voted for, were they Democrat? I had no idea, because they were my teacher, and they didn't talk politics in the classroom. They may have engaged us in things, and I think that's where it's a little disappointing. I remember my son, who was in eighth grade at the time, and he had a teacher who would send information home to parents via email, but always had a political start to it. Like, oh my goodness, the General Assembly decided that we could keep the lights on today. I mean, as a parent, I didn't want to know about that. I just wanted to know about my son, how he was doing in the classroom, in the assignment. And I think that's the kind of thing that needs to leave public education.
Well, just to I echo what you say, Senator. I'm thinking about Miss Burchett, my third grade teacher, who I ran into outside of Three Bulls in Clemens last year. And we were able to catch up and talk and come to find out she had been watching me quite a bit on social media and sort of knew some of the things that I was doing in life. And so, yes, I think teachers make a huge impact on every single child, every student. I think a lot of times the teacher doesn't even fully understand and realize the impact that they're making at that time. But those seeds that they plant just have a way of reaping a harvest much, much later on in people's lives. Just to make sure I'm clear, has the budget passed or it's getting ready to pass?
So both chambers, the North Carolina Senate and the North Carolina House leadership, have agreed on some budget framework. And so some of those were the raises that obviously an average of 3% for all state employees, or average around 8% for our teachers, and many other things, some tax triggers, other things that we have agreed on. And now all of the budget chairs, appropriations are meeting in each particular area: education, transportation, healthcare. So all those things, all those meetings are going on now. That's really where they're working out the details and some of the other things, but we have the framework. And so hopefully we will have a budget completely put together and passed and signed by our governor, I would say somewhere early or middle of June.
No, that sounds good. We'll have to check back in around that time. Here's one of my last questions for you, Senator, and I'm running over, but this is such great information and such a good conversation. Many North Carolinians, especially seniors and working class homeowners, just feel increasingly squeezed by rising property tax bills. Some lawmakers, including Senator Berger, are discussing caps or limits on property tax increases. Do you support legislative intervention here, or do you think these decisions should just be made primarily locally?
Well, I think, I served locally, and I do appreciate and do not want to step into overstep in local control. So every municipality that's located within my Senate district, they all have their own kind of character and flavor, and I think that's the reason that people live there, because of that. Those local leaders and what they prioritize for their community. But at the same time, I do think that we across the board have to look at how much we are taxing our residents. And so, and giving them, even though right now we do have ways, there are some programs for elderly and veterans and things like that. It's really hard to navigate and figure out some of those breaks. So I think one of the things that's being floated right now would be to put it to the vote of the people. The House has put together a package to have a vote and say, should we have some sort of constitutional limit on what the property tax should be? And so I think we're continuing to look into those things, if that's a viable option. I think the people's voice is the most important. On the Senate side, we just ran a bill that would personal income tax in our North Carolina Constitution is capped at 7%. And so right now there's a bill out there that would propose that we do another constitutional amendment and put it to the vote of the people to cap personal income tax at 3.5%. So I think that people are interested in that. I think it's important that in all forms of government, that we start to look at what's really, truly needed services. And then where do we start spending taxpayer dollars almost like it's contribution or charity? And so sometimes it bothers me when I see these community grants being given out, and $10 and $11 million to organizations that are really nonprofits. And I feel like so many times those are things where I, as a taxpayer, if I want to contribute to that organization, support what the work they're doing, that needs to be left up to me to spend my dollars, write them a check and contribute. But when you're taking and raising my income, my property tax or my income tax, and then as government, you're deciding what nonprofits to support, that seems like that's not really a necessity, a real service that you have to provide for residents, but something more that is a little bit more in the charity lane. And I think that's what we're hearing from across the state, that's what taxpayers are worried about is, use my money for the services. But when government starts kind of getting into some of those other lanes, I do believe the taxpayers are concerned.
Yeah, we often say that we don't want government picking winners and losers in the private sector, but we always seem to be okay with government picking winners and losers in the nonprofit sector. So we definitely agree with you. That's something that we ought to re-examine. Sounds like we may need to get you and your old friend Malachi Woodbury on the show for a debate here. I'm sure she'll have some opposing arguments to everything that you just said. Here is my absolute final question. You live in Kernersville. I always like to ask this question because I love hospitality and I absolutely love all our great locally owned restaurants that bring us together here in our region. So you live in Kernersville. What's one restaurant that you recommend in your hometown?
Oh my goodness. That would be hard to just pick one, but Out West, if you can get in at Out West, they have the very best filet, I think, that you will find. And we have a newer restaurant called Gaslight on Main, which was fabulous. And they have a wonderful brunch. So after church sometime, it would be a great place to stop in.
We are huge fans of Chef Bobby Lalutis. We love what he does out there at Out West. And so I think that was a great pick, as well as Gaslight. I've been hearing a lot of noise and chatter about them as well. So thank you, Senator Jones, for locking in. This has been another episode of Locked In with Algernon Cash. A special thank you to North Carolina Senator Dana Caudle Jones for joining the conversation and sharing her perspective on the major issues shaping education, government accountability, and public policy across North Carolina. And remember, real growth begins when we stop reacting emotionally and start thinking critically. If you value these conversations, then I invite you to support this work. Your donations help us continue bringing together leaders and thinkers who are willing to have honest discussions about politics, business, money, and the community issues most important to our state and country. Visit lockedin.cash to become a recurring supporter. Your contribution helps us continue producing independent conversations that elevate our region. You can also subscribe to my podcast on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify. Share this episode and send it to a friend. I'm Algernon Cash, and you've been locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.